Welcome to the Mormon News Report, your weekly dose of Mormonism.
With just a spoonful of snark.
And for those of you listening to us through the Cultural Hall podcast, welcome.
And just a heads up, this will be the last episode we cross-carry on the Cultural Hall podcast. From this point forward, if you want to continue listening to the Mormon News Report, you'll need to subscribe to our news show on its own feed. Brian, we are growing up. This is our parents kicking us out of the house saying it's time for you to get a job. It is very simple to do. Just do a search for Mormon News Report in iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or whatever app you use to get your podcasts. Also, another reminder, the Mormon News Report extended sessions are now available to Patreon subscribers. For just $1 or more per month, you'll receive access to the Mormon News Report podcast extended feed, which will have all the extended interviews in a convenient feed you can add to your device. So basically, you'll get a URL, you'll put it in your device, whatever you use to get podcasts on, and it'll download all the extended interviews. Your $1 per month will help the Mormon News Report team to drive more resources to providing you with the best coverage, commentary, analysis, and a sprinkling of snark to breaking Mormon news. So for those of you who do subscribe, I'm looking at you, Mormon Life Hacker, and I'm looking at you, Tyler Harper. Thank you for your support, and we hope to see more of you soon.
We've got a fantastic show lined up for you today. Tracy McKay will be joining us to talk about her new book, The Burning Point, a memoir of addiction, destruction, love, parenting, survival, and hope. And of course, we've got plenty of news to cover from the week. But before we get into that, Brant, you survived Utah.
Holy crap, Brian. Survived is the right word. I don't know if you know this, but it's hot in Utah.
Yeah, we refer that to as the refiner's fire.
Oh, man. And listen, I thought I was okay because we deal with a lot of humidity in Michigan. 80 degrees with 80% humidity is pretty hot. 100 degrees where you step off the plane, you step onto the asphalt and your shoe's already melting. That's a little bit more hot. And you know what? I don't know if you know this, but Mormons are everywhere, like newspapers, billboards. I saw Mormon stuff in Walmart. It's everywhere.
So did you get any souvenirs?
I kind of brought home an entire carry-on bag of Mormon books. I think I counted about 14 of them.
I'm sure your kids loved it. And your poor wife.
Oh, she was just overjoyed to say, oh, goody, we've got more books to add to the bookshelves.
Well, let's get into the news.
So if you recall from a couple of months ago, the LDS Church pulled out of the Boy Scouts varsity and venture programs for older teens. This week, they announced that they are moving forward with an alternative program to scouting for older teens. This program has been roughly outlined on LDS.org, along with resources for Young Men's Leader. The new Young Men's Activities program is being creatively called the Young Men's Activities Program.
It's all about pragmatism, Brant. Well, the page describing the program for young men leaders encouraged them to focus on the following principles. One, be with them, which I suppose is better than just dumping the kids off in the woods and taking off.
You know, maybe those missionary parents in Bryce Canyon from last week's episode, maybe they could have taken a note from this. Wow, a boy can dream.
So number two was connect them with heaven.
Listen, I've had a few close brushes with death during scout camp, particularly around food. I think that's about as connected as I need to feel with heaven. So I'm good there.
Well, and the third one was let them lead.
Or in other words, you know what? You kids go ahead and figure this out. I'm going to be over here on my phone checking Twitter and live tweeting the events for everyone to see what you guys are doing.
In all honesty, Brant, though, if you really want to make a program that connects with kids, I think you're better just doing this on like over Xbox Live or maybe just sending them like Snapchat snaps or something.
You know, that's not a bad idea. So instead of earning merit badges, they could unlock achievements or be awarded accomplishment based on the number of likes. I know quite a few people in the online world. That's how they live their life. So it's a good starter for what's going to happen next, right?
You got to speak to the kids, Brant. You got to speak to the kids. So looking at the suggested activities, though, my suspicions that this was going to essentially be a missionary prep program, they were confirmed. Check out some of these suggested activities. Learn about and experience missionary work, answering questions about your beliefs, skills for learning and teaching basic doctrine.
Well, I think the only things you're missing are filling out your missionary paperwork and how to prepare for the inevitable breakup letter from your sweetheart at home who promised she wouldn't wait for you, but is now engaged to some guy named Mark who she's known for 3 weeks.
Is this a personal experience, Brant?
No, not at all. Why would you ask? But seriously, Brian, I know most people have been wondering about the relationship between the BSA and the LDS Church. And based on this very early program, I think it's safe to say the writing is on the wall. It's a double-edged sword, though. As much as I think there is potential for scouting to be a force for good in the world, I really do believe that its reliance on tradition has made it largely irrelevant. And I know this from some relatively empirical evidence from talking to Boy Scouts within my own ward. However, if the church is going to replace scouting with essentially a mission prep course, I don't know if this is what I'm looking for either. I guess it's all a question on what is best for the youth. And I think we can see where the church is heading. And Brian, I don't feel, I'm not concerned at all to say I don't necessarily agree with it. I think the church could be heading in a better direction. But like I said, it's a double-edged sword.
Yeah, we'll see how this pans out. Speaking of missionary preparation, the church newsroom released a video this week showing what life was like on the inside.
Inside the MTC, that is. The video depicts the missionary training experience from being dumped curbside until we are launched out the door without purse or script.
Maybe a purse or a wallet or a smartphone or, you know, and a few talking points anyway.
Or a tablet. Here's a clip.
Here, we have the cafeteria where we get to eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner every day. Yeah. And they keep us really well fed. I love it. I love the endless chocolate milk. Really good.
Look, the MTC is basically missionary drill camp, okay? They're going to put a lot of rules around you. They're going to force you to do things a very certain way. But they're doing that because by the time you get out in the field, you might be in a situation where you're completely away from the mission office. So yeah, they have to do that. I understand it's not necessarily for everyone. And I also understand it could breed a really, really weird extremism that happens. But I'm not going to sit here and say the MTC was a horrible place. And I appreciate his enthusiasm because you know what? Don't mess with people's chocolate milk. But what they don't show in that clip is what it's like out in the field.
You know, I miss my mom and dad, and I miss my three older brothers, Mark, Jared, and Brian, and my three younger brothers, Luke, Paul, and Gary. However, despite all this, you know, at the end of these 2 years, at least I have my gal Linda to come home to.
Did you propose before you left?
No. I was going to wait till the mission was done, and then after I got into dental school and stuff.
Right.
What do you mean, right?
Nothing. I had a girl back in Vegas, but Heavenly Father had another plan for her, and she married a returning missionary. I've been on my mission here in Los Angeles for almost 2 years since then. I only have a couple of months left, and I don't really want it to end.
The MTC is currently rated at 4.5 stars on Yelp, noting quality food and good recreational activities. However, the Wi-Fi signal was a bit spotty and turndown service could be improved.
Particularly, no chocolate mints on your pillow. But seriously, what? Are we going to gloss past the fact that, Brian, the MTC is on Yelp,
right?
You know, so I follow Glassdoor a lot, and it tells ratings of companies and CEOs and stuff like that. The LDS Church is listed as one of the top 100 places to work for, with their CEO being rated 99%. And every time I see that, it makes me laugh. So that's why when I see the Yelp thing, it just makes me laugh. Anyways, switching gears, the BBC reported this week that a verdict was issued in the Bountiful Canada polygamy trial.
So Winston Blackmore and James Oler, both former bishops in the FLDS Church, were found guilty of practicing polygamy in Canada, where under Section 293 of their legal code, it is illegal.
Ah, yes, Section 293. We all know it very well, Brian. Winston is being accused of having 24 wives, while James was accused of having four.
Which makes me question, what's up, James? Like, only four, really? I mean, you kind of need to up your polyg game a little bit here.
I've seen the photos, and Winston does have a winning smile, so we got to give him that, Brian.
He looks like a real-life Cialis commercial. I kid you not. I mean, all we need is him in a hot tub on a beach holding hands with his 24 wives and his litany of potential side effects in Cialis, and you know we're all set.
According to reports, Winston has an estimated 145 children, and that's estimated.
Yikes. I mean, that's enough to make even Brigham Young say, whoa, slow down there, Winston.
Maybe, hey, buddy, hey, brother Winston, why don't you take it down a notch, huh?
So here's a clip from Winston leaving the courtroom.
Religious leaders, yes, but now Winston Blackmore and James Oler are convicted criminals. Blackmore remains defiant, slamming the trial as a government attack on his faith.
I am living my religion. It is a part of my faith. It is something that is hugely important to me and to my family and to my father and his father, and you know, going back and hopefully going forward generations. It's not religious persecution that bothers me. It's political persecution.
You know, there's a part of that clip where if you snip it at just the right time, it might come across as an LDS member talking about their views on religious freedom. Isn't it interesting how we all seem to be speaking the same language, even when it's from different parts of the religious spectrum?
Well, moving on, Utah legislative leaders are proposing to hire the top lobbyist for the LDS Church to head their Office of Legislative Research and General Counsel, or OLRGC, which it's frighteningly close to oligarchy.
In quite a few ways, I would add. According to the Salt Lake Tribune, John Cannon has been a lobbyist for The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints since 2012 with the title of Director of Community and Government Affairs, and his hiring may raise eyebrows for a legislature with a membership that is 90% Mormon.
Is there really such a thing as an LDS lobbyist? I mean, wouldn't we call them like voyeurists?
Did I hear you correctly? Did you say voyeurist with a V?
Bram, let's face it. With a 90% Mormon legislative body, I suppose that voyeurism is one way that you could describe the navel gazing that's going on inside the Utah's capital. Hey-o. But no, I said voyeurist with an F, as in what we refer to the lobbies of our chapels as, foyers.
I don't know what it's like in Utah, Brian, but here in Michigan, it's pronounced foyer.
This is America, Brant. We say foyer.
America, where our elected leaders bravely discuss the divisive issues facing our nation in 140 characters or less on Twitter.
Or is it Twitter?
In my neighborhood, it's pronounced Twitter. For this week's big story, Utah politicians, including State Representative Mia Love, Senator Orrin Hatch, and Governor Gary Herbert have all taken to Twitter, or Twitter, or Twitter, to decry President Donald Trump's recent tweet saying his intent to ban transgendered individuals from serving in the U.S. military.
So the reason, according to Trump, was to curb the tremendous medical costs and disruption that transgendered individuals apparently impose on the military.
Assuming Trump is referring to the cost of gender transition-related medical care is frankly a pure garbage argument, considering that the U.S. military currently spends five times as much on Viagra as it would on enlisted transgendered individuals.
Anchors away, my boys.
In the Navy, you can get your fill of men. How brave, Brian, for Utah's public servants to quietly tweet their opposition to Trump from the comfort of their gender-segregated bathrooms. Recall that Governor Gary Herbert was the same guy who only 1 year ago vowed to fight against the Obama administration's order to require schools to permit transgender students to use the bathroom of their choice.
So we don't exactly have a great track record in regards to transgendered rights from those who are so bravely speaking out against Trump. I mean, don't get me wrong. Being Republican in a very conservative state, speaking against the Republican president over a sensitive topic does take some gravitas. Here's a clip from Senator Orrin Hatch speaking on MSNBC.
Look, people who are transgender, they don't choose to be transgender. They're born that way. And why should we hold that against them? And they're human beings. And many of them are extremely talented human beings. So, you know, we should be open to everybody.
Will you be reaching out to the president or even some of these generals? Just see what...
Well, if he calls me, I'll certainly tell him my viewpoint I do reach out to him, and he reaches out to me quite a bit, too. So I expect him to. He's probably already paid attention to what I've said.
Yeah, you and many other Republicans could potentially change his mind, right?
Well, let's hope so.
You know, good on Senator Hatch for speaking out in support of transgendered servicemen and women. And I will say that is frankly surprising to hear him say that. My jaw was on the ground. I did not expect to hear that from him. Although he did mention that the president frequently reaches out to him. I wonder if he is reaching out or if he is grabbing him. Maybe that's something that we could debate at a later time. But, you know, at the same time, this is one of those red herring battles. According to research, enlisted transgendered individuals who may seek gender reassignment make up less than 0.1% of the U.S. military. We're not talking about a significant population here. So, Brian, I think it's important that we have context and perspective. All right. So I like perspective. Mormons make up approximately 1.3% of the U.S. military. So I haven't done math in a long time. Okay. So help me out with there. There are, if my math is correct, 13 times more Mormons in the military than there are transgendered servicemen and women. Any guesses on how many of them are popping the little blue pill? I was just in Utah, Brian. I've seen your billboards. To give us more perspective on this, we go now to our segment, Sound Off with Steph.
Orrin Hatch sort of reminds me of Senator McCain's speech, where it's really easy to say the right thing when the stakes are really low. And I hate to be the negative Nancy. No, actually, I really embrace my role as negative Nancy in the world. But yeah, this is an easy scenario for Orrin Hatch to have like a small victory, and people are going crazy being like, look, he did the basic human thing. He said that they were human beings and that some of them are talented and capable of serving in the military. And I think our standards have gotten so low for Republicans and for especially Mormon Republican men that we're celebrating like, oh, look, he's not a complete monster. And I would have a lot more respect for Orrin Hatch if he not only said, hey, not only can you die for our country, but you can also adopt children. And I agree that you should be allowed to get married and you should have full health insurance benefits, regardless of where you are in the military or not in the military. But I noticed that he's never willing to take that step. And it's the same thing that we saw with McCain on his speech on bipartisanship for healthcare reform, is that it's easy to say things and then not do things. And McCain voted for repealing the Affordable Care Act. And Orrin Hatch is like, yeah, well, if the president calls me, I'll let him know what I think. But I'd just be more impressed with people in general if they said the right thing and then did the right thing. So if transgender people are willing to die for our country, the least we can do is also say you have full rights in every other aspect of our country. And so I'm just not getting super excited about Orrin Hatch because I'm negative Nancy Debbie Downer. Can I talk about
Sunstone
for a second? Because I have opinions about Sunstone. So this was my first conference in, I think, 5 years that I've really been and participated in. And it's a great conference. Lindsay does a great job. The panels are great. The presenters are great. But I think in the past I've compared relationships with the church to a romantic relationship. And when it's good, it's great. And when it goes bad, that things get interesting. And I think some people approach Sunstone and they're able to be friends with their ex, which would maybe be the church, or their complicated relationship, or their non-committal makeout session, whatever your relationship with the church is, they're able to have a healthy relationship. And then there are people who come to Sunstone and it's the equivalent of a teenage girl driving by her ex-boyfriend's house multiple times in the evening to see what he's up to. And yeah, I saw a lot of like drive-bys where it's like, I have broken up. We are broken up. We are never getting back together, but I'm still going to have a really creepy relationship with things. And yeah, sometimes I think people need to graduate from Sunstone. Not everybody. Like I said, some people have healthy relationships with Sunstone and the church and like the fringe Mormon field. But some people just need to take a break and they need to graduate. And that is my opinion. No one asked for, but it's been on my mind all day.
And we'll be back with Tracy McKay. If you're looking for more current news coverage on Mormonism, why don't you try the Mormon News Report? The Mormon News Report is a weekday email sent hot and fresh to your inbox every day by 9 a.m., covering the top stories in Mormonism with just a tiny bit of snark. Our focus is on actual news from actual newspapers and reporters, covering all aspects of Mormonism. If you're interested in signing up, email us at mail@mormonnewsreport.com with your name and zip code. We use that for demographic purposes. You could like the Mormon News Report on Facebook. You could find us on Twitter at The Mormon News, or visit theculturalhall.com/mormon-news-report for more info.
L, he doesn't care for lesbians. G, he thinks two men should just be friends. B, to his dumb knowledge, is just a phase in college. T, he finds confusing, so the army's now refusing trans women who only want to serve trans men who...
We'd like to welcome onto the show Tracy McKay. Tracy is an adult convert to the LDS Church, raised in San Francisco by gently agnostic hippies. Tracy graduated with a communications degree from Eastern Washington University. Tracy relocated from the West Coast to the D.C. metropolitan area, where she lives with her husband, Jonathan, their combined family, and one very large and very dumb dog. That's her words, not mine, everyone. She blogs at By Common Consent and is co-editors, along with Emily Jensen, of A Book of Mormons, Latter-day Saints on a Modern Zion, which is one of my favorite book of essays to go back to. She recently published her memoirs titled The Burning Point, a memoir of addiction, destruction, love, parenting, survival, and hope through BCC Press. Tracy, welcome to the show.
thanks for having me, guys. It's kind of exciting to be here.
Yeah, well, happy to have you. So let me just go ahead and kick this off, Tracy. Now, talking about kind of the genre placement of your book, the memoir genre, you know, the ones that kind of stand out to me more recently by LDS authors would be like Joanna Brooks' Book of Mormon Girl, Jana Reese's Flunking Sainthood, or Elna Baker's The New York Regional Mormon Singles Halloween Dance. You know, each of these books, while they do contain their dramatic moments, they kind of tended more towards the lighthearted, self-deprecating humor, which, you know, before going any further, let me qualify by saying that our show is all about lighthearted, self-deprecating humor. So I don't mean
yes,
that
it in is.
Sense. But, you know, your book adds some emotional weight to the genre, and it's soul-bearing. It's candid. Also, rather than placing Mormonism at the center of your book, it seems to be a little bit more on the periphery throughout most of it, at least up until towards the end. But
yeah,
it isn't what's driving your identity through the book. So tell me about your decision to write this story this way, in a more dramatic sense, and with placing your religious identity more on the periphery.
Oh, wow, there's a whole slew of questions in that question. First of all, I'm delighted to be in the company of the three women that you mentioned. I've read all three of those books and I love them. You know, it's hard to write a lighthearted book about opiate addiction. Right. It's kind of, and that actually dictated the whole tone of the book and how I approached my subject, which was, you know, when you're approaching your heart, which is really what I was doing, my heart and my children's hearts, you have to do it with care and with tenderness. And while my Mormonism is a huge part of my life and it influences a great deal about me, when I went back to create this story, I wasn't a member of the church for a lot of the prehistory of it. You know, to tell David and I's story required that I step outside of that and go back in time. And it almost felt like I was time traveling in a bit, because I did have to submerge myself back into old memories and old details in order to write about them accurately. I knew that this wasn't going to be a Mormon book per se. It was not going to be a book about my conversion. And I intentionally kept it on the periphery, as you mentioned. That was an editorial choice that I made, in that, you know, there's so much about being a Mormon that's very specific, and I didn't want to get bogged down in the details of explaining what a ward was, explaining what boundaries are, explaining all of the minutia. I don't shy away from it where it's pertinent to the story. If you've read all the way through to the end, even my last conversation with David that I put in the book, right, it's very, very deeply personal and pertains to my faith. You know, it was that faith journey that partly led me to David. And he midwifed, for a lack of a better term, he midwifed me through a lot of those faith questions. So it was the story that was important for me to tell, was the story of why I married him, why I stayed with him for so long, and to flesh out that being an addict is actually not all that a person is. And I needed to tell that backstory in order to do it.
Well, and not only, you know, just sticking with what I was saying about your religion kind of being on the periphery, not only did you accomplish that being an addict isn't the center of what you are, isn't your only identity, you also were able to accomplish that being a Mormon or religious person wasn't the center or the only part of your identity. I mentioned to my wife as I was reading through your book, I said, this isn't a book about a Mormon woman. This is a book about a woman who is going through life, and then Mormonism becomes a part of it.
And that's exactly true. I was 29 when I joined the church. I was already a wife and a mother. I had a full life behind me. I'd already traveled and had a career, and I didn't come into it a blank slate. I came into it already a fully established human being, and it simply added to me. And that's how I approached it in writing. And that's how I continue to approach it in writing. I unflinchingly try to look at all of these things that I've brought with me to Mormonism and the things that have added to me from Mormonism.
You know, Tracy, just to go along with that, so this is a theme that we've seen in some of these interviews that we've been conducting. And it really started, actually for me personally, it started listening to an interview, and we've mentioned this before, on the LDS Perspectives podcast, where Laura Harris Hales was interviewing Scott Hales, who does the Garden of Enid cartoons. And one of the things he said was, I am so sick of these, and I botch this quote every time, so Brian, correct me if I'm wrong, but I basically, the essence of his quote is, I'm so sick of every story that starts out, if we're going to talk about Mormonism at all, we got to go through this whole thing. And I think from your memoirs and what else we're seeing is, as a Mormon people, I would hope that we're getting to the point where it just serves as the backdrop for everything that's going on. So like Brian was saying, it's not a Mormon story, it's your story, but that's where I'm hoping we get to as a culture and a people. Do you see us getting any closer to that? Or are we still falling back on some of the old tropes of, okay, now I got to talk about a bishop and a ward and all that?
I think we still tend to fall back. It was actually something I kind of fought for editorially as I was writing, because there was some feedback given to me of, oh, well, you need to describe what your bishop is. And I went, no. I'm not, because this is not a Mormon book, because if I do that, then I end up devoting an entire chapter to, here's the brief history of time of the Mormon church. That's not my job. My job is to tell my story. Being a Mormon, if you take a giant faceted stone, is just one part of who I am. And I'm not going to, I'm telling the love story of my life. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to devote any more than, you know, I included it where it was necessary. I included it where it was pertinent. I didn't shy away from it or glance off of it or minimize it. But I also, this is not an Ensign story. Mm-hmm. It was never meant to be, and it never will be. This is my story.
Mm-hmm. And if you're curious as to what a bishop is, there's Google, right?
Sure. Right. Oh my gosh. You know, go to LDS.org. I'm not a missionary. Yeah, you'll find it. Google Mormon. I promise you there's plenty of information out there.
So let's talk about the organization of how you chose to organize the book. You kind of go through more kind of present time to flashback throughout the book. You skip from maybe the 2010s back to the 1990s and then back. So what were your thoughts about organizing it this way as opposed to the traditional linear approach?
Well, you know what? It's really funny. I took a page out of Anne Lamott's advice when she said, just sit your butt in the chair and start writing and you're going to have a pretty crappy first draft. that's what I did. And the first draft was basically all the sad parts linearly. And I read through it and I handed it to my editor and I, oh man, that was a crap storm. and I looked through this rough draft and I realized that it was not telling the story that I wanted, but I had to write that crappy rough draft first in order to realize that. It was like, you know, dumping a big pile on the floor and then I could start sorting through it and building what I wanted to build. And when I did that, I realized I needed, and I did have people asking me, why did you stay with David for so long? Why did you stay through so many relapses? Why? And I realized I needed to show why. I needed to go back and show the person that he was and who I was and what we did for each other. We really did nurse each other through these things. And to do that required the time travel. And I went back and I started writing memories, basically. I just started writing raw memories down and I had piles of them. And then I started sorting through them. And that was when I realized that there were braids and ribbons weaving through of common themes that I hadn't even actually seen before. Like there's one scene in there where I talk about a scene where he was in the kitchen with his mother as a teenager. And then later on, he's in my kitchen as an adult while I am holding Abigail. I knew those stories for years, but I never drew the correlation between what happened with me and what happened with his mother until I wrote it.
And there was one memory that you put in there too, that I think really illustrates your relationship and dynamics, was you're canoeing together and you're both just doing it wrong together. And
it was awful.
Circles, right. You're just going around in circles and, you know, and it was him that said, well, we really need to be on the same page if we're going to be able to pull this thing together. And I thought throughout the rest of the memoir that always stuck out to me. I said, they never got on that same page. It was always in circles.
It's funny. I've thought about this a lot after the fact, because David and I actually did maintain a tremendous friendship for the rest of his life. We were not good married. We were not meant. It just didn't ever work. We were best friends. And I think if we lived in a place or a society where there was a place for men and women to be close but not married, it's like husband and wife is really the only model we have for a close male-female relationship. And so we try to put ourselves in that box. And I don't regret that at all. I believe that our children needed to be here, and I believe that we were supposed to be their parents. But I think had we lived in another time and space, he probably would have been some sort of wise sage holy man, and I could have been somebody who, you know, one of his pupils or something like that. But because there's not a space for men and women to have a close relationship like that, the only one we had was to get married.
Mm-hmm. So you lay out some really raw details of your experiences. You talk about your husband's opioid addiction. You talk about divorce. You talk about life as a single mother raising three children, one of them being special needs. I really can't imagine that's easy to relive those experiences while you're writing it. Can you describe a little bit like what that process is like? Because I've got to imagine that's, I'm going to be a little gross here, but I've got to imagine that's like scar tissue and you're in essence ripping it back open and rooting around in there to see what's there.
That's pretty much exactly right. When I decided I was going to write this, I told John, you know, my plan, and I said, this is going to be rough. Are you okay with me basically disappearing for a while? Because I'm going to have to. And he was incredibly supportive, and he said, you know what, you do what you have to do. And I, for about 5 weeks, locked myself in my office most of the day. I would come out at night, you know, to visit with the kids and things like that. Thankfully, they're old enough that, you know, I didn't lock myself in my office, but if I was having a rough day, there were times where I had to tell them, you know what, I'm going to just miss dinner tonight. Because you can't just turn that on and off.
Right.
I would be back sitting in that bank where they told me that, oh, you don't have any credit because your house is mortgaged. And I would be feeling all those feelings. And one of the kids would come bang in and, you know, want to talk to me about school. And it was very, very jarring. And I had to figure out how to put boundaries that allowed my life to continue to work while still feeling these feelings, because you cannot write about stuff like that from a distance. Not and have it have any sort of authenticity or vulnerability. I had to put myself back there. So it was hard, but I also felt like I owe David at least that much to try to tell his story and to try to tell our story. Because the thing is, if I don't do it, if I didn't try, there isn't anyone else. And his spark of beautiful madness and glory would be gone. I owed that to my children.
Now, how long did it take you to write this book?
Oh boy, you're going to laugh. Initially when we talked about the book contract with BCC Press, they had given me 6 to 8 months to write the rough draft, to get them, you know, a draft. That was the original window. I started it on December 31st and I gave them my rough draft on February 3rd.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So you, really, you immersed yourself in this.
I did. I did. And it was like a dam breaking. And I kind of knew that was what was going to happen, that once I sat down to do it, and that was why I put it off for so long. But once I sat down, there was no stopping it. It was just coming out, the story, because I'd been holding on to it for a long time. And once it just came out. And then the next job was, what do I do with this massive pile of raw material?
So I want to talk about one story in your book. It was titled Interlude One Saturday Morning. And this chapter dealt with David, who at the time you were separated from, but he overdosed on painkillers and he goes into a seizure right in front of your children, biting down on his tongue. There's blood everywhere. It's a very visual, graphic description that was given of this scene. Now, what's distinct about this chapter, though, is that despite how personal this is, you switch your narrative voice from first person to third person. And you do this a few times through the book, where you switch over to third person. Tell me about your decision to do that.
That was also an editorial decision, because I actually, when I went to write those scenes, I couldn't do it in first person. And for me to get it out at all, I had to switch to third person and remove myself. And it worked. You know, I had, my editors were encouraging enough that they felt like it was effective. And we had a couple of people in testing it and reading it who were like, well, but the more I read it and the more I did it for the scenes that were really hard for me to write, the more I felt like it was an effective way of showing through my words, not just saying, hey, this was hard, but actually showing experientially how hard it was. For the reader to also be removed with me, that I can't actually, this is so radioactive for me still all these years later, I can't go any closer than this. This is as close as I can get.
So I think it was an effective decision that you made. And it, it worked for me in realizing about the third time that you did it. It worked for me realizing that these are the most painful moments that she's discussing in these. And that, yeah, you had to have that distance, from it. And it's fairly genre defying, you know, in many ways, the book kind of, you know, kind of defied the typical conventions of writing for memoir. And I admire
Thank you.
That you're able to put into that. Now, ultimately, I mean, this is a story about struggle and redemption and hope. I want you to tell me about one particular experience in the book though. And this is your Mormon experience. I want you to tell me about your experience in the Nauvoo Temple. It seems to be it seems to have been a turning point in your story.
Well, interestingly, maybe it does come across that way in the story. It actually happened fairly early in David's drug use again. I was actually in Nauvoo for a conference with some other fellow Mormons, and we had all decided to go to the temple, and I'd never been in the Nauvoo temple. And it, as the only member in my family, I'd actually never been in the temple with anyone that I had been related to or loved. Like, you know, so many Mormons have this experience of the first time they go through the temple. There's, you know, there's their parents, their brothers and sisters, their family, I'd never experienced that. I'd been through the temple alone and with Mo, who I wrote about in the book. And so it was my first time being in the temple with a group of people that I loved. And when I came out of the changing room and they were all standing on those stairs, heading up to the upper floors, the sun was setting, and it was a really profound moment of a friend of mine took my hand and I just burst into tears. It was a very profoundly touching moment. And then we went up and we did a sealing session, which I also had never experienced because I was never sealed to David. Right. And that was actually something I had avoided because I was just it was too close. It was too personal. It was not something I could do, but because I was there with a group of people, it was okay. And then when we walked into the celestial room and I looked up and I love in the Nauvoo temple that there's a stained glass up there and the sun is above it. Mm-hmm. And there were all the symbols that I had put into David and I's marriage contract. It was right there. And I felt so profoundly connected. I felt like God sees me, even if I'm unconventional, even if I don't have all the items on my list checked. He sees me and he's aware of me and he knows me and he's holding me close in ways that I can't even feel because they're so all around me. And it was a lot of oil for my lamp all at once.
So Tracy, a very big part of your life in the book really has been your story about non-traditional family dynamics, whether it was with your first marriage and then your life as a single mother with your children. And now in I guess, lack of a better term, a combined family with your new husband and his family. But I'm really intrigued to see not so much your experience as far as being in a non-traditional family, but more the experience of people around you, specifically our kin, the Mormons. Basically, are we getting any better at non-traditional family dynamics? And how did you experience any of that?
Do you want me to be honest?
I want the honest.
Lie through your teeth.
I'm terrible at that. You know what? We're trying. We're right. trying. I think individuals are getting better. I think people, there's just not a better good-hearted group of people in general. Mormons are willing to try their hearts out. Mm. Collectively, it's still really hard. We don't go to church on Father's Day. We don't. Yeah. We don't go to church on Mother's Day. There are just days I don't subject my kids to it because we like to say, you know the phraseology, we teach to the ideal. Mm-hmm. Well, the truth is not one of us meets the ideal. Yeah. I don't care if you have the perfect sealed family and there's no divorces anywhere and you've got no empty chairs. none of us are meeting the ideal. That's the whole point. And it's particularly painful when you have children who've lost a father, no matter how good their stepfather is, and he's wonderful. It is painful. It is painful. And I have learned just, you know what? We take that Sunday off. I have been in exemplary wards, which is what I wrote about. I have been in wards that are absolutely terrible. It really just depends on the people. It depends on the people. It depends on the sensitivity of the leadership. It depends on how comfortable people are with their own dissonance. Yeah. I think if you have a Relief Society president, an Elders Quorum president, and a bishop who have experience in an imperfect life, you have a lot more compassion within the ward. Whereas if you have leadership that is trying to put forth a particular face, you have a lot more dissonance and discord.
It has really been great having you on. And hopefully we'll see you again in the near future, maybe with some future stuff, maybe, maybe not. Keep us in the loop.
That would be great. I will.
You can find Tracy's book, The Burning Point, in both ebook and hard copy format through Amazon and bccpress.org. And also, for those of you in the Utah area, at Utah bookstores such as Benchmark and Writ and Vision. And we'll be right back.
Apologetics can be defined as a defense of faith through argumentation. Christian apologetics comprise some of the earliest forms of Christian writings. Throughout the centuries, apologists have argued for the reality of God, legitimacy of Scripture, the creation, the fall, the preeminence of grace, and the eschatology of the end times. Adding to these, Mormon apologists have defended Joseph Smith's first vision, the embodiment of God, continuing revelation, extra-biblical scripture and temple rituals, among other topics, and have reached new levels of sophistication through training in fields such as history, philosophy, and Near Eastern languages and culture. Through multiple perspectives, the contributors to this volume explore the textures and contours of apologetics, revealing deep ideological fissures within the Mormon studies community concerning its utility. In spite of these deep-seated differences, what each author has in common is a passion for Mormonism and how it is presented and defended. This volume captures that reality and allows readers to encounter the terrain of Mormon apologetics at close range. Learn more about perspectives on Mormon theology, apologetics, by visiting gregcoford.com.
And now for your moment in history, brought to you by Today in Mormon History. On July 26, 1857, Heber C. Kimball publicly prophesied, "And the President of the United States will bow to us and come to consult the authorities of this church to know what he had best to do for his people."
Well, you know, Orrin Hatch really isn't that far removed from the highest seat in the nation, so.
I'm not sure if that's a good or a bad thing, Brian.
And that's our show. We'd like to thank Tracy McKay for being our guest. Remember to check out the Mormon News Report's extended sessions on Patreon. Just visit patreon.com and search for the Mormon News Report, or go to patreon.com/Mormon News Report.
As a matter of fact, Brian, we've got an extended interview with Lindsay Hanson Park, which is very, very good. I'd highly recommend everyone to get that. You can get a small 20-minute clip if you listen to last week's show. But if you want the full 40 minutes that we went with her, you got to go to Patreon. And remember, for those of you listening to us through the Cultural Hall, this will be our last episode carried on the Cultural Hall feed. So if you'd like to continue listening, you need to subscribe to the Mormon News Report directly on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. We'd like to thank Steph Lawrenson for joining us. Music was performed by Scott Holmes.
And we'd especially like to thank you, our listeners. Hey, if you like what we're doing, tell your friends about us and give us a review on iTunes. It really helps when people are searching for the podcast.
And if you want to reach out and let us know how we're doing, reach out and touch us, or you can reach out and grab us. You can email us at mail@mormonnewsreport.com. We would love to hear from you. Until next week, we'll talk to you again after a while.